Hello, and welcome to Through Dangers Untold, Chapter 4, The Goblin King, a week chapter-by-chapter breakdown of the classic fantasy film that is Labyrinth. I'm your host, as always, Elwood, and joining me, of course, is my co-host and Labyrinth's enthusiast, Emily.
Enthusiast is not a big enough word, especially for this scene that we're going to be doing this week. Like, no one is prepared for my notes. Not even me.
I did get forewarned of this before we were recording. It's sort of like, Elwood is not prepared for what I am going to unleash this evening.
At all. Like, and I've been on several platforms over several years discussing this particular moment and how it affected my entire life going forward. And here we are in the sort of like creme de la creme bowl of creme de la creme. And I just really want to do it justice, and that basically means I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes, about 2 seconds of screen time. So as long as we're all cool with that.
So tonight, as we're talking about The Goblin King, which is probably most noteworthy for giving us our first introduction to Jareth, the also-popular Man of the Hour. In our previous chapters, Sarah obviously has been introduced as this free spirit who has been left alone with babysitting her stepbrother Toby, but unfortunately, due to saying the wrong words, Toby has now been kidnapped by the goblins and taken off to the castle beyond the Goblin City. And it's now that we pick up our story where we left off last week, where things were getting a little spooky because Toby had just gone quiet and disappeared, and now we get a little bit of introduction, horror antics, as we have the owl scratching at the window, we've got the spooky strings happening, we've got goblins in the background, and it's just a really wonderfully choreographed sequence.
Yeah, it's very Hereditary. It's very like the end scene from Hereditary, and I will push that reference until I die. It's so good. And this music that's playing currently isn't on the soundtrack. I would know because I listen to the soundtrack every day of my life. And it's not on there. It's not anywhere to be found. So I don't know. I spent a good 25 minutes trying to find this music. Can't find it. Don't know where it is. It's just, I don't think there was a composition for this moment in the movie. I think David Bowie just sort of like was around the camera and music came down from heaven to just accompany that. That's the only reason I can think as to why it's not on the soundtrack and why it's so good.
Yes, it's very sort of incidental music, but at the same time it's sort of expanded upon. So it really sort of adds to the scene, and certainly when you're a kid it's a pretty intense scene to be watching, especially if you're not a big horror sort of kid. It's pretty sort of intense, the fact that you've got these goblins lurking in the background, and whenever you have things lurking in the background that and just not making their presence known, playing the taunting sort of behavior, it can be feel a bit intense. And the same going for that owl sort of scratching at the window. We got the stormy weather, we got the rattling of the French windows. It's just really well put together, but at the same time not being overplayed by Jennifer Connelly.
I was going to say, her, like, noises are so good. Like, they're so well done. Like, they're just very, like, a good pace of, like, noise and, like, fear and worry. And they're just very real. They're very real. She's a very, very good actress. And I know a lot of people who have, you know, looked at me and seen some sort of Labyrinth clothing on my person because this is how I live my life, and been like, oh yeah, Labyrinth. Oh yeah, no, like I watched that when I was a kid and it was way too scary. So I think this is definitely one of the first scenes that would put you off if you were a child. And I know that if I had come to this movie before the age of 13, which is when I did come to it, I probably would have been put off by this scene. I was a very frightened child. I was scared of everything. And this scene would have really turned me off this movie, and then I never would have watched it, which, you know, is just really tragic to think about. But I know a lot of people that were very scared of this film, and I think this must have been sort of when they started going, I don't know, man, maybe I'm gonna turn it off.
I remember feeling like that. back in the day, I remember it being kind of intense. But at the same time, once you get it, it's sort of like you got to get through this bit, and then we're into the labyrinth. Because it's just nothing but fantasy from here. And normally when you have, like, the journey to the fantastical place, it is normally really scary, or it's frightening in some way.
Trippy.
Yeah. There's numerous examples we can look at. We can look at, obviously, like, Willy Wonka. We can look at the...
Down the Rabbit Hole.
It's also a memorable tale. Yeah, Down the Rabbit Hole. You've got to go through this. I mean, the Wizard of Oz, again, we've got the whirlwind sequence.
Yeah, fuck that. That's so scary.
So we can obviously see it as being part of the fantasy journey. I mean, even like Neverending Story, I mean, he has to be driven into the attic for his fear before he obviously gets to enter into the fantasy world of the Neverending Story. So,
yeah.
And which I can't remember the name of.
Who can't you remember the name of?
In Neverending Story, I can't remember the name of the land. I just remember bits and pieces. You see, when you think of Fantasia, I just think of the Disney musicals. That can't be right.
Fantasia! Bastion's gotta save Fantasia! Atreyu! Coming soon, The Neverending Story, chapter by chapter. you've made a really interesting point in terms of, like, the usual transition into a fantasy land. It's very quick here, and we'll go into it once we ramp up to that moment, but there's no sort of tumbling, there's no, like, whirlwind, there's no, you know, you consider the references that were in Sarah's room in chapter 2, the homages, if we will, to that sort of, you know, fantasy world growing up story. This is very different from them in that it blurs reality and fiction quite well, which is why I've always stood by the this is really happening as Mia Farrow would say, who's in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, Mia Farrow.
This isn't a dream, this is really happening. That was my Mia Farrow. You're welcome.
The thing I remember most about Mia Farrow's haircut, though, is just from that movie and the fact that Tyra Banks spent 4 seasons of America's Next Model butchering models just to get a girl who that haircut worked on.
You gotta have the cheekbones, like, honey.
She's like, I'm gonna have my Mia Farrow. I'm gonna have my Mia Farrow. And she just, like, tried it 4 different times until she finally got her Mia Farrow.
Hair is very... I don't know what the... It means a lot to a lot of women, Tara. You can't just fucking hack it off willy-nilly, like...
And yet the makeover episodes were always the one everyone tuned in for.
Yeah, it's like torture. It's like, you know, it's like Freaks when they turn her into a chicken lady. I'm not down with that. It's no wonder I didn't watch that program. I hate that kind of shit. But what I don't hate, great segue, Emily... is after all of this commotion and the scratching at the door and Sarah making some really good, like, oh, noises, and all the hereditary goblins hanging out, the music literally, like, pauses. Like, the music itself is doing a bunch of crazy stuff, and then it's like... Like, it just, like, pauses itself when the French doors are flung open... A shit ton of glitter is pumped into the room, and I have the same reaction whether I'm watching this scene for the first time at age 13 and it is emblazed in my memory, or whether I watched it 5 minutes ago for the 29th time today. David Bowie standing in the window, surrounded by glitter, with the music going, I will not be the only person to have this. My entire life changed in that moment, my vagina awoke. And I knew what it was to be a woman. Like, it is indescribable how that moment makes so many people feel. It is majestic. It's gorgeous. It's breathtaking. David Bowie standing in the doorway, surrounded by glitter. I had never seen anything like it, and yet I had in my head seen it for years. It was so familiar and comforting, and yet so new and special at the same time. And it is the best moment in cinema. Full stop.
It's certainly a moment that everyone says that they have experienced some sort of awakening, or felt like when you climb the gym ropes. It's certainly an entrance. It's certainly it's not so much an entrance. It's just Bowie announcing himself as the Goblin King. And he doesn't just like shrink in the room. He just appears in the room. And he does so with such a sureness about himself. And it's a full commitment to Bowie. It's not someone warming up to playing a character. It's someone fully invested in who this character is. And as we've said on previous episodes, when it comes to Bowie, he's played a number of different characters over the course of his musical career. So him playing the Goblin King felt very much like one of those personas. So we can kind of in many ways understand why he took to it so fully. But he's standing there and he's got his hands on his hips. Normally when you have like a villain or a figure of a note or status sort of enters the room, they gesture with their hands and they command or orchestrate the room. Bowie, as the Goblin King, is standing there with his hands on his hips. He's got, as you say, he's got the stardust blowing in behind him and there's
power
a slight
stance.
Breeze. Exactly. It's a real cocksure stance, and you are just like left to take in this fantastical vision of Bowie, which chances are when you first watched it, you had no idea who Bowie was.
I did not.
Just like myself.
At all.
I did not realize that Bowie was a big deal for years and years after. But I just knew that he did the music in the film, and it was good. And certainly when he talks, there sounds like there's a little adjustment with that accent.
Because oh my god.
He swerves off a little bit too much to Thomas the Tank Engine land. and he's like, it's a little bit shaky to start until he sort of like tunes in on where the accent's supposed to be. But everything he says is a statement.
No.
As well.
His voice is perfect. It's almost metallic. It's like he was mic'd up and there was like a tech problem, but it works so well. Like, Sarah is there in her like normal voice, and he has to be this robotic alien. He's a Goblin King. He's like, he doesn't look like any of the puppets around us. He's David Bowie in the best costume. He wears 8 costumes throughout this movie, by the way. This is number 1 out of 8. We will talk about it. And you know, she's like, what? And he's like, what's said is said. And you're just like, what are you? Like, it's so good. And then she's like, I didn't mean it. And he's like, oh, you didn't. Like, I know what you mean when you say his voice isn't quite like warmed up. But
it's,
you know what else is good? It's because he's in the human realm and he's just transformed from being an owl. So if you really want to like deep dive, you could say that his vocal cord is still like readjusting into like goblin vocal cord from owl vocal cord or whatever. But like, it works so well. Like, it's so iconic and it's so memorable and it's so fun to impersonate. Like, I love it so much.
It's I mean, it's a very unusual sort of scene, because when you listen to, when you look at the dialogue of these two characters talking, it feels that these, that Sarah's actually encountered the Goblin King before, rather than it being a surprise that the Goblin King has turned up, which just confused me then, and it still confuses me now, if there was like a story before Labyrinth, where we've had this sort of courtship of Sarah by the Goblin King, and that he's done all these things for her, and now the fact that she's used her power and now regretting it, that is one of the first times that he's now turning against Jareth.
I think she's just very brave. That's what I always took it to be. She has such autonomy and such confidence, and she taught me those things. She taught me that it was okay to be in control and be brave and have confidence and stand up to these people and think what you think and know what you know and learn as you go, but still stick to your guns. And what's really lovely is that one of the first things Jareth says to her is, go back to your room, play with your toys and your costumes, forget about the baby, like, stay in your childhood, go back to your room and stay in your childhood. And she replies with, I can't. Not, I won't, or I don't want to. I can't, because she knows she's got to grow up. And she's going to drag herself into adulthood because she knows she has to. But by God, she's going to do it her way. She's going to do it by following sexy, sexy David Bowie into a beautiful concept of a labyrinth surrounded by Jim Henson creations. And that is how she is going to reach adulthood. And she is in control. This is her imagination. And she is doing it. And she is brave. And she is standing up to him. And it is, she's so important. I really think she's forgotten as an icon in terms of young girls growing up, because, you know, she doesn't have superpowers and she's not physically strong, but she's so confident and brave and powerful. And I really attribute me being so awesome today to watching Sarah in like the early 2000s, aged 13, because she is such a good role model. Yeah, sure, she's a fucking brat. Who isn't when they're 13? And she learns not to be a brat, and that's the whole point. You know, like the kid in Where the Wild Things Are. Nobody's fucking hating on him. Yeah, and it's just so important. And, you know, the way she responds to Bowie, it does seem familiar, but I think it's just that we're not used to seeing women standing up for themselves and talking to adult men in this manner. We're just not used to seeing it. Especially when we know that the adult man has a crush on the teenager. Now, that is the last I will mention about the age gap and the problematic relationship, because Flo is not here and I don't need to apologize for how I feel about this relationship, because it was pivotal in my development and sexual awakening, and there is no one here to make counterpoints for Jareth's character. So I am being unapologetic now.
It's funny, when I look at these two characters, I never even consider the age gap. It never comes into my mind, the fact that Bowie's obviously older than Sarah is.
Way older.
Yes, I know. And I think, I don't know whether it's because in your mind it's sort of like he's a goblin, which means that age doesn't matter. It's the same as Arwen in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but you know that Liv Tyler and Viggo Mortensen are like vaguely on the same. You know, we're talking about a 14-year-old Jennifer Connelly and like a 40-year-old David Bowie. Like,
I know, and it's creepy. It should be creepy as all hell.
This is the thing.
The performance is so charming, and because they never go to that place.
And because it's fantasy. And yeah, there's like no kissing, there's no canoodling, there's none of that. So it's all implied. And I think that's how, A, they get away with it, and B, we let them get away with it. Because, you know, my friend watched, as I said, she watched it as an adult for the first time, and she was like, well, that was creepy as hell, and made some very valid points about how creepy it is. And I was like, hush, there's glitter. so it's allowed. It's problematic.
It's like a lot of these things. When you watch it, because more than likely you probably watched it when you were a kid, and you hold a lot of that childhood nostalgia when you watch it. And of course, you didn't question it when you were a kid, and when you watch it now, these are characters that you know and you love, and you just go with the flow because it's the story that you like. But when you look at it from sort of a critical sort of lens, there is no sort of obvious romantic connection. It's more just the fact she's sort of got besotted with Jareth and his charm and his charisma. And
Sarah is sort of like
this plaything to him.
Yeah, sorry, that she was besotted with him. I was like, yeah, and like, you know, you read some of the stuff, which I never like doing because it's always dumb. And they're like, Jareth first fell in love with Sarah when he saw her in the, like, bedroom. So the implication is that he hadn't fallen in love with her. He first fell in love with her when... And it falls into that trope as well that I used to be a huge fan of, and now it makes me feel physically sick. Okay. When, like, the man meets the woman and the woman is like, fucking don't touch me, you're disgusting. And the man sees that as like, ho, I like 'em feisty. And you're like, go die in a hole. Like, no time for it. No means fucking no. Go away. And this sort of falls under that. But as you say, because it's all sort of implied, and there's only really one moment in the whole movie where we're sort of confirming Jareth's feelings for Sarah, and up until then it is sort of like a plaything. You know, like, riddle me this, Batman. It's more sort of like, it could be read as that, rather than... You know,
yeah, this first initial encounter with Jareth, he's very much this tormenting style figure. And it's funny you mentioned the line that you went with, because you wanted me to obviously point out the second track where it's sort of all in her head. That would be his little speech there, where he's saying, "Go back to your room." That would be normally like one of the first sort of breaking points where you have a character trying to be drawn back into the real world, be by a medical professional or whoever. That would be like one of those first breaking points, the same way that in the prison it's sort of like, I'm number three, who's number one? And and like number one is supposed to be basically the different doctors in the prisoner. If you've never seen The Prisoner, that's going to be completely lost on you. And of course, you've never lived. Because The Prisoner is awesome.
I don't know, man. I've watched Labyrinth over 100 times. I think I've lived.
And when he's obviously, as I said, in this first initial encounter, he's such a tormenting character. The fact that he's plays on Sarah's sort of like free spirit nature by hypnotizing her with a crystal ball, because he knows that's going to sort of play into her dreams, and the fact that it's sort of like, it's a magic crystal, it will show you the life that you want. And these are sort of like very sort of things that tie into that, the sort of girl that Sarah is, that she likes things like, you know, crystal balls, these sort of fantasy sort of like toys. And to have but like a magic crystal. Ooh.
Again, Sarah's instantly like, no, I'm not interested in your fucking crystal ball. Like, it's a very clever effect. Well done. Because, of course, you know, they had that guy doing the practical effects of the crystals, standing behind David Bowie.
Michael Moshin.
So good.
Did, the crystal effects. He's a physical juggler, and he was a classmate of Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller. The two actually worked together on juggling performances after they left high school. But he's done a number of bits and pieces. He did ads for Motorola. He's done work with Cirque du Soleil. He did work in particular for the Las Vegas residency. Nice. So he's... It's surprising when you have like these magicians and the careers they have. It's like... You look at Saved by the Bell, the magician that used to run the diner did the magical effects for Britney Spears' circus tour. And you think, how does the magician get such wonderful, wonderful gigs?
Yeah.
But he's actually got, he won the a fellowship from the MacArthur Foundation, which is the genius grant.
Oh. So
he got like $1 million just to do whatever he wanted with.
Nice.
He also has done a TED Talk where he describes some of his thought processes as well. So if you want to see some more about his sort of like mindset, you can obviously check that out. But it's a really... You understand now why Bowie's got his hands on his hips, basically, so the Martian can shove his hands through there and manipulate balls. And I have
without,
to say, the camera...
Like, blind. Like, he's doing it
yes.
blind.
He looked physically exhausted, because there's a clip we put up on our Facebook page where it shows some behind-the-scenes footage of him doing the ball manipulation for this scene. And he looks, like, mentally exhausted when he comes away. He just, like, breathes his sigh of relief. He's like... and then goes off, please yeah. have a coffee or something. But yeah,
it's so good, and like, you know, it's really happening. And because it's his arm through David Bowie's arm, even though obviously they've positioned the camera angle where you're not meant to see that, it still slightly looks like something's a little bit off, because he's doing it and obviously David Bowie's shoulder is staying still. So there's that little bit of uncanny valley where you know they're doing a trick here, but you know it's all real. So that's another really magical thing that I think really works well with the Goblin King, where he looks sort of a bit disembodied at points when he's doing these tricks. And it's so good. It's so great to watch. And yeah,
well,
he offers
her... I never had any idea. Honestly thought it was Bowie doing it. It was only,
yeah.
I would say, the last couple of years when I looked into this film more, and it was sort of like, no, they had some guy behind him just like doing the bowl tricks. But still, to do it blind is no easy
thing. Even more impressive.
And when you're actually looking out for the arm movements, I think there's like one shot in this bedroom scene where it's slightly askewed, where his arms aren't quite matching up with him. I wasn't obviously looking for shoulders, I'm just looking for arm position here. But still,
it really plays into it.
So key to Zhao's character. I mean, yes, of course he's going to have a thing, because as all, you know, great people with great magic do, they have like a sort of playful magic to them, something that they do just to demonstrate their power. And obviously with him, it's this magical manipulation of the crystal balls, which becomes so key within the, as the film goes on. So,
and aesthetically, it's so good as well. Aesthetically, it's great. And he offers one to Sarah, and, you know, she's being polite when she's like, what is it? And he's like, it will show you your dreams. And almost instantly, again, Sarah is like, I can't. It's not that I don't appreciate what you're trying to do to me. And then it turns into a snake and he throws it at her throat, which again, when I was 13, I didn't know what negging was. Now, I think if you were
really?
To watch it, you might... Yeah, I was 13. I don't even think negging
had been
invented.
No, I'm just saying, you're seeing this as negging.
If he's in love with her, what is throwing a snake at your beloved's throat if not negging? I'd like to turn your attention to the 2017 live-action version of Beauty and the Beast to see a whole movie of a main character negging. Yeah, so as a 13-year-old, I was like, he's evil and can't be trusted, therefore we're not in love with him. Cool. I can be in love with him as an audience member, but Sarah isn't, because she's brave and clever. Let's get on with the movie. And because I never believed that Sarah was ever going to end up with him, it was even more comforting, you know? Because I was like, name me another fucking movie where that fucking happens, you know? And, so, what was I talking about? Oh, yeah, negging. So he throws, a snake at her throat. And, yeah, now if I watched it, I'd be like, ew, stop negging. That's what I have to say about that.
The other key sort of aspect of this scene is the fact that he's not just playing for Sarah's attention, he's also playing to his goblin followers as well, because they're greatly amused by these antics as they like randomly appear and then they disappear, and it's so well synchronized.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the timing is so spot on for these.
It's like a play.
These creatures.
It's like a panto.
Yeah, and it's not the fact that they just disappear when Sarah turns around. It's at the same time they disappear. It's sort of like, and disappear on 3, 2, 1, bang. And it's like so spot on the timings her turning around.
It's magic. Again, I'm going to bring it up every week, but like when Kermit blows the candle out in Muppet Christmas Carol, Jim Henson did magic. He just created magic.
It's funny you say that, because there's a scene in the next chapter which I felt exactly the same.
Mm. It's literally magic. So she denies the crystal ball. She gets thrown a fucking snake at her throat, which is so uncool. Like, it's just not cool. And the snake turns into a goblin, but that's beside the point. And she's like, please, please, please. I immediately regret all of my decisions. Where is my brother? He's there. Is that the castle beyond the Goblin City? And we're in the labyrinth. It's so clever. It's so quick. You almost don't realize it's happened. We have gone from the bedroom to the outskirts of the labyrinth with just a close-up and a pullback. There is no creepy tunnel. There's no chickens getting their fucking heads chopped off. There's no... There's none of that bullshit. We're just in the labyrinth.
No, because we already covered that already, haven't we?
We're in there. We're in the labyrinth. Because
we just sort of like went a different way around it, really. So, but yeah, we're finally at the labyrinth, and
we get to see it.
As Bowie, with his still wonky accent, goes, "It's further than you think."
Okay, we need to talk about that line. I've got it here as a note. There's a few things before that line that we need to discuss. We need to break down everything that David Bowie says in this movie. We get to see the labyrinth for the first time. It's a beautiful concept design. You're already sort of seeing that it has different elements to it, like Disneyland. You've got the like Tomorrowland section and the Fantasyland section, the little greenery and the desert bit. So it's huge and it's beautiful and it's cool, and there's a great bit of music that swells up. And we're on this really like dusty, bizarre, almost desert-like terrain with this like broken, glittered tree with no leaves. Like, it's just beautiful. Aesthetically, it's just gorgeous. It's amazing. And she's like, "Is that the castle beyond the Goblin City?" And David Bowie, again, which is why I always took him as a good antagonist and not a love interest, is because he's like, "Turn back, Sarah. Turn back before it's too late." And that just sounds like me when I'm talking to the year eights at the school that I work in. Like, it is dripping with sarcasm. Like, he doesn't give a shit. He's just, like, here for shits and gigs. Like, he's just toying with her. And it's delightful because she is so determined and she's like, "Fuck yeah, here comes my fucking coming of age quest. Let's fucking go. Labyrinth time." And he's like, "Oh, turn back, Sarah." And it's so sarcastic and I love it to pieces. She is so on it. She's like, "It doesn't look that far." And you're like, "Yeah, you go, Sarah." Like, and this is the thing as well. She's constantly combating him. Like, he may be negging her, but she is like kind of negging him back a little bit. She's like, "Call that a labyrinth? I'll show you a fucking labyrinth." And he, like, he, like, steps forward and, like, comes really close to her and is, like, right next to her and is, like, "It's further than you think." And she's, like, "Oh, my God, he's, like, really close to me." But, again, it's, like, it's only implied sexual. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not there if you don't want it to be, and it's there in droves if you do want it to be. And I think that's really respectful, giving the audience a choice as to how sexual they want their coming of age tale to be.
Definitely so. And we obviously here get the rules of the game, as we're told that Sarah has the 13 hours to beat
you
the labyrinth.
You have 13 hours to solve my labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever. Such a pity. Again, welcome back to Emily just quoting Labyrinth.
And we obviously have the wonderful clock, which I only noticed when we started this project, has 13 hours on it.
Of course it does. You got 13 hours, Elwood. How many hours on the clock is it going to... Is it going to, like, do 12 and then
I didn't pay attention to it. I was too wrapped up in the...
13 clocks. Your clock is too good. It's Labyrinth.
Notice as well, we have the dawning of the new day over the labyrinth.
Hell yeah.
Because this is a new beginning. And we have the orchestral score. It's rising. It's sort of like she's rising to the challenge and we're setting out on this big adventure. It's like at this point the adventure begins.
Yeah.
So this is Frodo leaving the Shire. This is other people venturing off on quests and things.
Other people doing some stuff. Yeah, yeah, it's like hardcore, and she's not afraid. She's wary, but she's not afraid, and that is so important, and I'm going to keep pushing how important Sarah is as a character with how brave and resourceful and clever she is in a way where, you know, I think of Alice and Dorothy, like, no fucking offense to the two of them, and they were born a lot earlier, you know, we're talking like 1930s, 1940s creations here. But, you know, Alice is just crying so much that she creates, like, a fucking lake of tears. And then she's all like, I give very good advice, but very seldom take it. She just cries all the time. And then Dorothy is there like, huh? What? I thought all witches were ugly. And then you got Sarah, who's like, doesn't look that far. I can take it. Whatever. Labyrinth, labyrinth, schmab, labyrinth. What? Wait, what? Labyrinth, schmabyrinth. What? Labyrinth, smab. You know what I'm trying to do.
Just say the line.
I can't.
What does Sarah say when she sets off on her epic quest? What's her first words?
Well, come on, feet.
It's like,
do you have any idea how many times I've said that to myself out loud in real life?
I know, but until we started this project, I didn't realise how much I enjoyed when waiting for you and excuse you to have you say it. So, because you said it on one of, I think it was like our first episode, and it was like so pitch perfect. It's all like, oh, I was just going to say the line. It's going to like be like the Troll 2 line. But better.
I love it. I love it so much. And it's true because, let's deep dive into that, even though it's technically on the next chapter. Well, come on, feet. My feet. Me and my feet. Me and my body. It's just me that's going to get me through this labyrinth. I don't have a fucking magic key. I don't have any magic fucking shoes. It's just me. I'm going to reach puberty by myself with my own body. Let's go. Let's go. Come on, feet. It's you and me. Sarah is amazing. So I have a quote here from Desperate Housewives, which I've never seen, but I came into the room one time as my mum and sister were watching it in time to hear this quote about one of the characters. Martha Huber waited her whole life for something to happen to her. Something exciting. As a child, she hoped to be kidnapped by a band of pirates. As a teenager, she dreamt of being discovered by a Hollywood talent scout. As a young woman, she fantasized that a handsome millionaire would sweep her off her feet. But the years had flown by, and still nothing exciting had ever happened to Martha Huber until the night she was murdered. Anyway, who cares about Desperate Housewives? I listened to that quote and I was like, never have I been so upset by someone like laying out to me what and who I am in such a tragic, sad way. And Labyrinth encompassed that. Labyrinth was so perfect. It drove that line so badly and so well, sorry. Like, badly in, like, a good way. You know how, like, kids are saying sick is good these days? Because, like, it was Dorothy and Alice, but for the modern teen, it was... It kept you in the real world, but gave you that escape route. And we'll talk about it more, especially once we get to the ending and all the implications there. But it would just, that quote always stayed with me because I used to watch Pirates of the Caribbean and be like, I wouldn't mind being kidnapped by a bunch of zombie pirates and flung around on deck because it's kind of sexy and cool. But Labyrinth surpassed that and remained important to me after I got over my pirates phase because it balances the real world and the fantasy world so well. And it gave her her teen adventure without it being, like, traumatizing. It's very low risk. Like, the Labyrinth, like, the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to lose your brother. And, yeah, like, that's really bad. But, like, beyond that, the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to fall down a hole. Or, like, someone's going to say that your mum's an armadillo. Or, like, you know, everyone's just a bit kooky. There's no, like, fucking, you know, things that, there's nothing that's going to eat you in the Labyrinth. There's nothing that's going to, like, hurt you in the Labyrinth. It's all just, like, kooky little goblins that are like, ah, what you want, ah, you know? So it's perfect. Just a low-risk adventure with some Muppets. Perfect for a 13-year-old. Super cool.
And the right now, I'm just happy of the embracement of the heroine model that is actually finally coming back to the forefront after how many years now? I mean, obviously, this is produced back in the mid-80s. And what we're now in sort of the 2020s, and we've had to wait this long to get films like, you know, Black Panther and Captain Marvel, and even to have to put more comedy sort of extent like Charlie's Angels. Just the fact that, you know, women can kick ass too. And it's the fact we've just not been bothered to acknowledge this for a long, long time. I mean, how long we had to wait for a Black Widow movie that's still yet to come out?
Fucking forever.
Yeah.
We got a Ghostbusters movie and everybody shat on it.
I know, that's another raw sort of nerve, and I think a topic for another day. Because we'll be here a while.
Me, you're not ready to fight me on Ghostbusters 2016.
No, no, no. Completely opposite. I love Ghostbusters 2016. Yay. I think it was very unfairly shat upon. Yeah. And the fact that all the people who had something, who really sort of had a valid, you know, say in what was happening with the world, were all super happy with how the project turned off. The only thing that Aykroyd said he disliked about the project is the fact that Feige kept spending too much money on the project. So there was no way for it to ever really claw it back, especially when you were doing the sort of rejig of things. And the fact it was set up to introduce this whole Ghostbusters multiverse, but no, you have a bunch of whiny fanboys complaining about how it's ruining their childhood. And
yeah, if you're not gonna like the movie, don't go and watch it.
It's hard to look at this new movie coming out as nothing more than just like an apology to sort of appease those whiny sort of fanboys.
It's so disgusting.
It makes it hard to be excited about, even though it's constantly charming me. And I think that's why they put Paul Rudd in, because it's impossible to be angry at Paul Rudd.
They got Paul Rudd in to appease all the masses, because I'm like, I'm not going to be mad about it because it's Paul Rudd, but yeah, I'm a little bit mad about it.
I can't be even angry at Halloween 6, which is awful, because Paul Rudd's in it.
He makes everything better.
He does. He's like this calming presence. So
I love him. He doesn't age. We just need to really quickly cover Jareth's outfit. Number one, okay, out of eight. It's like a leather number with a high collar and a breastplate. Sort of sexy armor to invade your local teenager's home with. It's good. It's solid. It's a solid outfit. Good intro, nice sparkly cape, gloves, good hair, great makeup. All in all, a great look.
Great. I have nothing else to say. I didn't even realize he had multiple outfits until you just pointed it out.
Yeah. Yes, he has several outfits and they are all
beautiful. I just
thought he took
like a shawl off and stuff and
no, this one's
he just
like
took layers off.
This is literally like sexy armor. He's got like a breastplate on and like gloves, like leather gloves. And then when we see him in a minute, he's gonna have completely changed his outfit. You'll notice it now that I've mentioned it. And so will you, listener. So will you.
Well, that brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us, and leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and even now we are on Facebook.
Whoop whoop.
You can also check out our show on YouTube as well, so thank you for Emily. And you can also, on the same channel, check out Emily's show, Why This Film?
Whew.
Tapping into the nostalgia of all our film watching past. So yeah, that's all out there to go and check out and share with your friends. If you know anyone who does like Labyrinth, please let them know about the show. If you've got someone that you've fallen out with at the moment, please spam them with our show. It all helps raise the profile of the show, which is great. And we've had some really great positive feedback so far, and we're just really enjoying putting this together. So if you just spread the word, people, be our goblin army.
Yeah.
But as I said, this brings us into tonight's episode. Thank you to my co-host Emily.
Whoop whoop, thank you.
And we'll be back next time with Chapter 5, Hoggle.